For Sounds of Dissent, I'm Amy Grunder. Cambridge Ridge and Latin High School in Cambridge, Massachusetts, has an extraordinarily diverse student body, one that reflects the kaleidoscopic racial, ethnic, and economic composition of the city. With over 1,500 students speaking over 64 languages, the school mirrors what our next guest calls the new face of America. With its growing populations of Latinos and Asians, Africans and Afro-Caribbeans, and people of mixed heritage. More communities across America will increasingly look like this one, he says, yet most people lack the ability to talk intelligently and honestly with each other about race. Our guest is Lawrence Blum, a white college professor who taught a course on race and racism at Cambridge Ridge and Latin High School over a span of 4 years. His new book, High Schools, Race, and America's Future, What Students Can Teach Us About Morality, Diversity, and Community, is the compelling story of what he calls a remarkable adventure in teaching and learning about race in America in a multiracial, multiethnic classroom. Lawrence Blum is the distinguished professor of liberal arts and education and a professor of philosophy at the University of Massachusetts Boston, where he teaches moral philosophy, race theory, moral psychology and development, and multiculturalism. Welcome, Professor Blum, to our program.
I'm glad to be here.
Why did you decide to teach a high school class on racism? Let's start with that.
I had been teaching an education course at UMass and teaching people to become teachers, but I had never had any experience in the pre-college level, and it was starting to feel a little dissonant to me. So I didn't know what to do about this exactly, but one day I was talking to one of my children's teachers. My children all went to Cambridge Ridge and Latin, and I asked this teacher whether she felt that the high school was making the best use of their incredible diversity that you mentioned. And she thought about it for a minute and said that, no, she didn't think they had been making the maximal use of that. So I asked if I could, if she thought I could arrange to teach, to give an after school, like a discussion group with kids of different races about racial topics. And she said she thought that was a good idea, but that I should talk to the social studies coordinator. So I called the social studies coordinator, and she said, that's theoretically a good idea, but kids can't do an after school. They can't do an after school discussion group because they have work and they have homework and they have sports and stuff like that. But could I teach a whole course on racism? Well, I never thought about doing that, but she said that she would ask the principal about it and get back to me. She called me back the next day and she said, you're on the books for a course on racism the next semester. Well, this was definitely beyond anything I had ever thought before, but I just kind of rolled with it, and that's how I got started, and then they invited me back 3 more times to teach that course.
There's this notion that race and racism, those subjects, belong to Black history courses, that somehow race has nothing to do with white history. I wonder if you could tell us, can you compare what you were doing with this course with other courses, traditional offerings on these subjects?
Well, the high school does have courses. I mean, it had courses when I taught, and it continues to have courses, as far as I know, on African-American literature, Afro-Caribbean literature, African-American history. So there was that kind of presence in the high school. But my course was a course on the history of race itself, the idea of race. Where do we get this idea? So, you know, for contemporary, especially for young people, they think of their race as just part of who they are. You know, it's just like a kind of a given. And I wanted them to sort of be aware that that race was an idea that came upon the scene at a certain point in the history of the West and in American history in particular, and to see that it wasn't always like that, that there was always, of course, people with different phenotypes, with different, you know, physical appearances, but that the idea of race as a way of thinking about those differences was something that really arose in the the European conquest of the Western Hemisphere and the displacement of Native Americans, and then, of course, with the advent of slavery, basically, the idea of race sort of it started to arise, and over several hundred years into the 1800s, it sort of was forming and congealing into the notion of race that we're familiar with.
You deliberately set about creating a class where Black students were in the majority, and I'd like to ask you why you think this was important.
It was partly because the honors level classes in many high schools across the country and in Cambridge Ridge and Latin, the honors classes and the AP classes, the advanced placement classes, tend to be kind of white dominated. And I wanted to give an intellectually challenging course, an honors course, that was primarily targeted at Black and Latino students. I mean, it's kind of well known that part of the reason that Black and Latino students, that there's kind of an achievement gap, so as it's called, between Black and Latino students on one side and white and Asian students on the other side, is because there aren't enough intellectually challenging courses that are given to that population, to Black and Latino students. So I just wanted to make sure that I was on, you know, I was going against the grain on that and giving a course that was very intellectually challenging, but that the primary recipients of that student, of that class.
How many Black students were there, or students of color, I should say, were there in the class?
Well, so over the 4 years, the mix was a little bit different. It wasn't something that I could completely control, but as you mentioned, the school allowed me to have a little bit of control over the general demographic. So so the Black percentage went anywhere from sort of 40% to 55% over the years. The Latino population was kind of around 15%, which that's about what the percentage was at the high school. And white students were generally about a third of the class, somewhere between kind of 25% and 40%.
There's an argument that the presence of even one member of a dominant social group in a classroom might cause others to adjust their words and their behavior, as if it's as if that person becomes a symbolic presence of the larger group. Did you feel some trepidation about your position as a white professor?
Well, certainly if the one white person is the professor, that's different from just if they're the other students. So I did want to have white students in the class. I didn't want it to just be a class of Black and Latino students. So this is an indirect answer to your question, but I'll get to it. I wanted all of the students to learn how to have these conversations across that racial divide. That was a very important kind of second goal of mine, besides having it primarily be for the Black and Latino students. I wanted the students of all different groups to learn to do something which you know, Americans can't do very well, as you mentioned. It seems to me that Americans don't talk about race very well. A couple years ago, Eric Holder, the Attorney General, mentioned that I think it was during Black History Month, that he thought that Americans didn't talk with each other about race, especially across racial divides, and people just came down on him as if that itself were a kind of racist remark, where it was really just a quite accurate observation about Americans' ability to have productive conversations. And I wanted my class to be a place where students learned how to, how to talk to people in different racial groups, which does mean that you sometimes have to adjust what you might say. You might say something different if it was, if you're among your friends, or if your friends are kind of all of one racial group, you're going to talk differently than if you talk across those divides. And I wanted them to learn how to do that. So, you know, that was an important goal. So yes, I'm a white professor, and I was concerned about what the effect of my being white was on the class. I did work each year. I worked with a teaching assistant of color who was a UMass student who was aiming to go into education. So I did have, as part of the leadership team, there was always a student of color, and there were actually always black students, all four of them, just thinking about it, were black students. So that was that, you know, that helped with that issue a little bit. But I also just want to say that, of course, it makes a lot of difference that I was white, and that affected the dynamic in ways that obviously I can't know exactly because I can't step out of my own shoes. But I do think that over time, when you teach a course like that, you become more of an individual to the students as time goes on. You know, when I first came in, like the first day, some students expressed sort of amazement that they had this white teacher teaching this course on race and racism. So they were like just kind of seeing my race right there. But, you know, over time, as I got to know them and they got to know me, that's not to say my whiteness ever disappeared. I don't think it does disappear. But I do think that white teachers, who after all are the huge majority of the teaching force, I think white teachers are able to teach a course on race if you're sufficiently knowledgeable about it. It makes a lot of difference if you really know the material and you're sensitive to your students and respectful of them and create a kind of trusting atmosphere where they can say stuff and maybe they would be nervous that you would come down on them because you were white, and then if you don't come down on them but are instead really, you know, that's like really interesting, Joseph, you know, tell me more about what you think about that issue. Over time, I think it really can work for the white teacher to be teaching this racial material.
Larry, we seem to be having a bit of interference on the line. Hold on for just a second while I try to correct that.
Okay.
Welcome back to Sounds of Dissent. I've been speaking with Lawrence Blum, a professor who taught a course on race and racism at Cambridge Ringe and Latin High School. We have him back on the line. I'd like to get back to the actual class, the course that you were teaching. You were speaking just a moment ago about almost a kind of, well, I think you called it racial literacy, something the average American lacks. You started your course with scientific criticism of the concept of race, the historical construction of race. Tell us about Audrey Smedley, who she was, and why her work was central to your course.
So Audrey Smedley's book, Race in North America, it was one of the first books to synthesize the history of the development of the concept of race as it was interwoven with especially the history of slavery. And really that book is what allowed me to teach this course. It was a perfect text for the course. It synthesized both the history of slavery and also the history of the kind of displacement of Native Americans, but it interwove it with the history of the kind of development of the, you know, the science, or what we would call pseudoscience, of race. You know, race was thought to be wrongly a scientific concept, and that gave a kind of legitimacy to the popular ideas of race that were emerging with the entrenchment of slavery in the Americas, basically. So Smedley herself is an anthropologist. She's an African American, probably in her 70s now, and she was a real pioneer. I went to visit her during the time that I taught the course, and I report that in the book a little bit because I wanted the students to see that people who wrote very academic books were kind of regular human beings, and I wanted to personalize the text for them. The text is extremely challenging. I mean, it's not something that would be normally used at the high school level, and Smedley herself was amazed that I used this book for my high school class. It was a book that I was using in my college class. And in order to help the students with it, I gave them a lot of reading questions to kind of guide them through it. But anyway, so she was just this kind of pioneer in the study of race, and she sort of described how she was one of the first people to sort of think about race in this broad historical sweep. And she, you know, as an anthropologist, she understood a lot about the history of science as well, and it's just a fantastic book. It's really fabulous.
How did geographic and cultural differences in England on the one hand and Portugal and Spain on the other lead to differences in the way that race and skin color came to be regarded in the United States, Latin America, and the Caribbean? She talks about that, doesn't she?
Yes, so that's quite a complicated issue, but so in the United States or in the British colonies, the people who came over tended to come over in families. I'm kind of oversimplifying a bit, but they tended to come over in families, whereas in the Spanish and Portuguese colonies, it was men who came over. So the men who came over mixed with the indigenous population and then later with the slave populations. So in Latin America, you have much more, you know, kind of a history of racial mixing. And so the sort of rigid lines, racial lines that you have in the United States and the, you know, segregation, for example, in Latin America, they didn't have laws that enforced segregation the way they did in the United States. And so the idea of a sharp divide between black and white doesn't exist in the same way in Latin America. There's still quite a lot of racism in Latin America, but it takes a different form because of that, because of those historical differences, which, you know, I've given you just a little bumper sticker version of.
How did knowledge of this history change the way your students were able to talk about race, or the way anyone talks about race? I'm thinking that knowledge of this history makes internalized racism of all people, not just white people, internalized racism easier to examine without denial or without guilt. What do you think?
Well, you know, so some of my students had Caribbean and Latin American backgrounds, and that was one of the reasons that I wanted them to recognize the, you know, to sort of study this comparative race, you might say. But I also wanted people in the United States to recognize that the way we think about race is not the only way that the idea of race developed. And I thought that would help to sort of make it easier for them to see that race was not just like part of the furniture of the world. It wasn't just part of the way things absolutely had to be. And so that would allow them to have more of an emotional distance, both intellectual and emotional distance from the idea of race. They could kind of examine it. And because they could examine it, they could see that it was an idea that, you know, was a very oppressive idea that had oppressed their ancestors and still continued to carry, you know, a strong stigma into the present. But because they could kind of examine it, they could see it as an outside force. It wasn't just something that was lodged inside them. So, I mean, that's just a fabulous, you know, it's basically a thing that any kind of intellectual study could do. And I wanted to focus on that strong intellectual study that would give them the tools, the mental tools, the critical thinking ability to distance themselves from the idea of race, to look at it, to examine it, to, you know, I had them write papers about the idea of race, and I think that was something that allowed them to, you know, at least partly get past some of the internalized racism that they might have and also the racism they had towards other groups.
Can you give us some examples of racial ideas from the slave trade period that persist in stereotypes understood and experienced by your students?
Well, yes. I mean, you know, basically the idea in slavery was that blacks were this inferior race of beings. They were not mentally competent. They weren't capable of taking care of themselves, and that's why it was, you know, allegedly appropriate for slave masters to own them and to run their lives. And that idea by no means disappeared with the end of slavery. And in fact, in some ways, it actually got worse during the segregation period. It got more entrenched. And that is such, you know, something that's so entrenched in the history of a country isn't something you can just overthrow that easily. And it really lives on. I remember one time that one of the students told me after the class was over that our study of that idea of black inferiority, that the fact that we were able to sort of examine that, which we did in connection with Thomas Jefferson and David Walker, who was an abolitionist, black abolitionist, who was based in Boston, who wrote this outraged critique of Thomas Jefferson's views that blacks were inferior, that the student said that exercise helped her to see that blacks weren't really inferior. Now, she didn't say, I thought that blacks were inferior, but the way she said that implied that at least that idea had some effect on her. You know what I mean? So an idea can have an effect on you even if you don't fully embrace it. It can still be in there. It's like what you were saying about the internalized idea. But, you know, so that's an example of an idea that still, you know, clearly this student still felt that there was, you know, the idea of black inferiority was still kind of out and about in the world that she lived in, and she was glad to have the tools to feel like she could now see what was wrong with that idea.
And you're saying that idea was propagated by Thomas Jefferson, with Thomas Jefferson, who had a black mistress?
Well, I mean, he didn't invent the idea, but he had an important role because he was, you know, this very distinguished leader, but also because he was a kind of scientist. I mean, he was really an amazing person. So when he wrote in Notes in the State of Virginia, which is in 1787, he wrote about black inferiority, and it was quite an elaborate idea. You know, thing that he said about black inferiority. So it gave a kind of legitimacy to that idea. I mean, the idea was definitely there, and if he had never existed, it wouldn't have been that different. But still, he did play an important historical role in legitimizing and sort of, not that he propagated it actively, but the fact that people could then refer to the fact that, oh, Thomas Jefferson says this thing, so that the slave holders and the slave owners, people who were invested in slavery, could cite Thomas Jefferson and so on, that was important. And yes, as you mentioned, he had some contradictions in his life.
I'm thinking about how the fact that so many of these ideas are, that their origins are unknown and not terribly, people are not conscious of their origins, makes them easy to exploit. For example, I'm always amazed at the number of people, well-educated people, who believe that the majority of people receiving welfare are African-American.
Uh-huh.
And of course, it's not true. So,
right. You
know, if you don't know where these ideas come from, you're liable to be influenced by them.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I wanted the course to be a history course. I wanted them to see that this idea of race had this particular history, that it changed over time. So on the one hand, you know, taking your point, I wanted them to see that this is kind of why we have these ideas. But also the study of history helps you to see that you didn't have to have had that idea. So like one of my students at one point said, well, suppose black people had been the ones who owned slaves and the Irish had been their slaves. What would we now, what kind of idea of race would we now have? Well, that was a fantastic question to ask, but it sort of grew naturally out of the historical study, because then they saw, oh, it didn't have to be that way. You know what I mean? There is sort of a sense of the inevitability of the hierarchy, that, you know, the racial hierarchy that we have in this country, that I think is part of what makes it harder for people to envision the fact that we actually could have a world in which there was genuine racial equality. I mean, a lot of people sort of talk about racial equality as if we already have it, which, of course, we're very far from having it. But I think, you know, many people on a deeper level don't really think that we really could be equal. So they hear the statistics about, you know, blacks have, you know, $35,000 is the household income average, and for whites it's $54,000, something like that. People think, I think a lot of people think, well, that's, yeah, well, you know, no surprise there, kind of.
But did what the students had to say about race surprise you? I'm thinking you have a chapter. Tell us about the N-word incident that came up that you describe in one of your chapters. You write about how students of color make interesting choices about whether to use it and how these choices relate to a kind of fluid sense of community. Could you explain that?
So, This was a bit of a complicated situation where I had had a unit on the N-word with a kind of pro and con, but then in a subsequent year I had run across an African-American parent at sort of a meeting where parents kind of weighed in on the curriculum, and she said that she thought it was wrong of me to teach this the way I would to college students as a pro and con thing. She just thought I should say, you know, we do not use this word, and that I should treat it as a disciplinary issue. So I agreed with her, and I lifted, you know, I took it out. But then one day the students started talking about it anyway. So, I mean, one lesson in there is you're teaching a high school class on race. You cannot control everything that's going to be talked about in the class. So, you know, I was, like, freaked out. And, you know, this parent had said, I'm supposed to do this disciplinary thing, but I actually didn't know how to do it. So I just gave myself over to this conversation. And the students started talking about the use of the word. And they clarified the difference between pronouncing it nigger and nigga. And they say no black person would ever use nigger. And so, right. You know, a lot of white people don't know that distinction. And there was this one moment, maybe this is what you're referring to, where it had been mostly black students who talked, because I think that the non-black students recognize that this is like a minefield topic, and they're just waiting to see, you know, when it's okay for them to come in. So so a white student said that the way black people use it as a kind of term of affection and a kind of in-group solidarity, you might say, was like the movie Revenge of the Nerds, where the nerds take the word nerd and they turn it around and make it a source of pride and group solidarity. So that was a kind of unusual contrast, you might say, between the N-word and nerd. Another N-word. And there was an African student, right?
Or
I'm sorry?
Wasn't there an African student as well?
Yeah. Yes. Okay. I'll finish this one. I'll get to that.
Sorry.
So a black student sitting in front of this white student. So I just didn't know if people were going to accept that comparison, because it seemed the nerd thing was so trivial. It's a stupid movie. But a black student who turned around and said, yes, it is like that. And so there was this moment where this girl, whether she was, you know, fully intending to do this or not, was creating a sense of community that embraced this white kid, when she could have said, which, you know, and some of my college students, when I've had a similar, you know, discussion like that, would say, no, those two things are completely different. They have nothing to do with each other, which is, you know, either one of those things is a reasonable thing to say, but it was just a kind of wonderful moment of a sense of, well, we're all in this together. So then several minutes later, there was an African student who hadn't been speaking at all, and he was from Ethiopia. But I didn't actually know that he had come from Ethiopia. I knew his ancestry was. But he, to me, he just kind of dressed the way the African-American students dress. And he said that he thought that he himself could not use that word because Ethiopia hadn't been colonized by Western powers. You know, it had just been attacked by Italy in the Second World War, but it hadn't been colonized, nor was it a source of the slaves that came over to the Americas. Well, that's an amazing thing for a student to say. But the way, what he was getting at with that was that that meant, he wasn't saying it with pride. He wasn't saying, you know, I'm above you guys because I didn't, you know, we weren't colonized. It was almost the opposite. He was saying,
it's almost respectful.
I can't use this word as part of my, I can't get into this solidarity group. I can't get into this group of people who gets to use this word with affection with each other. And, you know, that, so I feel bad about that. I mean, that's essentially what he was saying. It was just like an amazing moment. And then the other black students basically said, come off it. You're a black, young black male. People are going to refer to you as the N-word, and you're one of us. So that was another kind of interesting communal moment in the class where, similarly, a student had said something that could have put him outside of a solidarity group in the class, but the other students brought him into it. Now, of course, the solidarity group in that case was the black students, whereas the solidarity group in the former case was the whole class. And what I talk about in that chapter is how, in a way, you want both of those things to happen in a class. You do want the black students to feel like they can have a sense of ownership, they can have a sense of solidarity, they can have a sense that this space belongs to us as black students. But at the same time, you also want a sense of community that goes across the different groupings that make so that they're all feeling like we're all learning together. And I sort of talk about, you know, this kind of colorblind idea would demote the black solidarity and say, no, you don't want the blacks to have that specific group inside the class because that detracts from the larger, you know, sense of community. But I don't agree with that. I think you can have both of those at the same time in a, you know.
Interesting. I think we're going to have to end, right? I'm going in just a minute. I'm going to ask you one last question.
Uh-huh.
Who's your intended, about the book, who is your intended audience for it? And what news does it bring us about ourselves as a society?
Well, so I'm hoping that teachers will read it and sort of think that it would be good if they tried to engage in this kind of racial literacy and brought more of this material into their classes. I would like professors to read it who would never have thought of teaching high school, which I hadn't thought of for most of my career, and think, oh, you know, this sounds really interesting. I'd like to try to do that. And I would like just the public to read it because people don't recognize that if you give students an opportunity to really engage on racial issues, they just, you know, for most people, race is just thought of as a minefield. They don't think of it as something you can have a productive conversation about. But to see these 17-year-olds so thoughtful, so interesting, so insightful about these racial issues, and you see them making progress, you know, through conversation, you make progress. That's why learning is so great. So I do hope that the general public would you know, sort of recognize the need for them to engage in something like this and maybe learn so much, you know, more about the history of race in the United States and elsewhere that would enable them to have those kinds of conversations too.
Thank you, Larry Blum. It's been a privilege having you with us today.
You're very welcome, Amy. I really enjoyed it.
We did too. We've been speaking with Lawrence Blum, Distinguished Professor of Liberal Arts and Education and Professor of Philosophy at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, about his new book, High Schools, Race, and America's Future, What Students Can Teach Us About Morality, Diversity, and Community. For Sounds of Dissent, I'm Amy Grunder.